again, shifting gears to grant programs. All this SES stuff is a really good idea, but how in the world do you make it real, in particularly in some communities more than others? So our next three speakers have experiences in that. So I'm going to let you read their bios. Looks like Craig, are you up first?
Yes, I am.
No photo. Craig goes first. From one Bay Area grant program, so from up north. And then joining us from, did you carpool with?
I did.
It's a good thing. Did you ride your bike?
No.
Sinking.
Not today.
Marco Anderson from Southern California Association of Governments and a colleague of Ellen's. And finally, Colleen Clemenson, who is a principal regional planner for the San Diego Association of Governments. So, I don't know, do we each have 7.5 minutes also?
10 minutes.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah,
there's only three of
us. Because this is Melissa's group.
Actually,
we're going to
get an hour.
Okay, the health people, I'll try to do a better job next time to advocate for you. All right, please. Craig, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. Follow the money. So this has been a very exciting program for me. These have been 15 years at MTC that I've been working on the program inside of the house. This program represents the first time we really took a new direction on how we allocate funds that came from UEC, the federal discretionary funds to our projects.
Technology? Lindsay, help.
Film me now.
People on the phone might have a little trouble hearing you, I would bet.
Just to give you some information about who MTC is, we're the Metropolitan Planning Organization in the San Francisco Bay Area. We have 9 counties. We have a separate council of governments, which is different than the state, which is the Association of Bay Area Governments, which we work very closely with in this whole effort, as well as developing sustainable community strategies. We have 101 cities, and we have a comprehensive multimodal transit network with 6 rail lines. We have 8 primary public transit systems, as well as numerous other local transit operators, and we have that totals to approximately 25. So we have definitely have a lot of coordination that we have to do. I just wanted to go over really quickly some of the building blocks that underlie the One Bay Area grant program. One is our last plan that you had to push this region to go through, as well as all in California. Responding to California Senate Bill 375, where we had to start looking at land use issues a lot more closely together with the transportation investments that we were recommending in our transportation plans. And the intention of that was to have greenhouse gas reductions and have look at addressing housing issues in the region as well, and looking at transportation and land use planning. So one of the most the centerpieces of our sustainable community strategy was that we wanted to have focused growth. And this would need to have, in order to have a sustainable way to handle the strong growth that we're experiencing in the Bay Area. And the goal was to be able to build on investments that have already been made in our region, whereby we would leverage existing infrastructure, and we would increase transit access in places where it made the most sense, together with new housing and jobs, and integrating the location of the future growth with the new transportation investments that we were making. So we had something called the priority development area, which targets areas where most of the investments should be made on a policy basis. And those would be downtowns, main streets, and corridors with a strong transit access identified by, and these are identified by our jurisdictions. It's not a top-down regional approach. They go to their cities go to their counties go to their boards, and go through the Association of Bay Area Governments to receive this designation. It's a little bit small, but the map shows those areas in red are the priority development areas. We have 170 of them in our region, and a very strong emphasis, in addition to transit, is providing a pedestrian-friendly environment as well. We also have a priority conservation area program and designations as well, which is a whole other presentation. But we also are looking at the flip side of where we should be protecting our region and such as agriculture and environmental sensitive areas, and have a program for that as well. All of you by now are, I'm sure, quite familiar with the regional housing needs allocation, the law that we have in California. This is another tool that we have to implement the sustainable community strategy. And you'll see later on how we wove this into our grant program. And the California HCD Housing and Community Development Department leads this, and ultimately, after allocating housing units to jurisdictions along different income levels, and the allocation goes down to the jurisdiction level, the jurisdictions need to have a general plan housing element and zoning in place that shows that demonstrates that they'll be able to accommodate those housing units. And this plan was the first time that we linked this whole housing issue to our regional planning and the transportation goals. So it was quite significant. So we put together a funding program to provide incentives to get us where we want to go and support what we were doing in our regional plan and the sustainable community strategy. We wanted to reward jurisdictions that had priority development areas and chose to produce housing or transit and create healthy communities. So we have requirements in our program having to do with investments in priority development areas. And we provided to jurisdictions more funding overall and made funding a lot more flexible in terms of what the needs of the communities are as well. So for our agency and probably many other MPOs, the most flexible funds that we have are the federal transportation funding that comes to the region, which are the surface transportation area program funds and the congestion mitigation air quality funds. We normally work with our region about every 3 or 4 years and decide how these funds will be used to fund a myriad of programs in our area. For the One Bay Area grant, was a new way that we decided how we would allocate and use the funds. We had $795 million over the 4 years that we were looking at. We split this into two separate pods. One pod was for regional programs that our agency administered, and that included freeway service patrol, 511, various planning programs that we administered to the region, Then what was left over after funding the regional program was $320 million, which we subvened directly to the nine counties. And we worked closely with our county congestion management agencies, and they ran their own call for projects, and it was their board and their separate outreach that selected the projects that met the overall rules of the program that our commission adopted. And we had significant public outreach. We spent 1.5 years. Given that this was a whole paradigm change in how we allocated funds. So we involved a number of our committees. We have many committees that we've worked with on a number of things that we moved forward, including active transportation, local streets and roads working group. We had a regional equity working group, and we have an advisory council as well that directly advises our commission. So we provided a lot more flexibility for local decision-making within the OVAC program. Compared to the cycle before, we downscaled a number of our regional programs and needs that the agency was the sponsor on, and in order to funds to the counties for local decision making, we get a larger pot that would help to which increase 150%, but the local share of the overall program that we gave to the CMAs for their own decision making went from 20% of the pot to 40% of the pot. We also had various programs, separate program silos that we worked with the CMAs program, and we combined those, and we used project eligibility criteria within those programs as well. So this probably was the largest shift that we made in terms of what jurisdictions felt is the impact of this program was how we distributed the money. Previously, we had various programs that used transportation factors in some parts, maybe population, but we looked at we have local streets and roads rehab program, so we would be looking at pavement condition. But now we totally went away from those factors in those programs, and we distributed half on population to kind of temper the transition that we had. And then the other half was based on housing in the region. A quarter of it, which is the orange, is based on housing production looking back. Our commissioners wanted to show that we were looking at what actually was produced. And then looking forward, we used RENA in terms of what cities were willing to take housing, that there would be a reward that they would get housing funds to implement and support the priority development areas. So as a result of this, it was a whole different way of allocating funds. And those that took on a lot more housing ended up seeing a much larger percentage of the pot than they did in the previous. The requirements. Requirements of the program. So they got 70%. So this money went to the counties, the CMAs, and then they had to meet the requirement that for the larger counties, 70% of the funds that they allocated to grants had to be within the priority development areas. Smaller counties had a 50% threshold. They also had, each county had to also work with all the planning directors that come to develop the priority development area investment and growth strategy, and that would help inform future rounds of funding and how funds in the PDAs would best be used. In terms of leveraging local policy results at the jurisdiction level, these would be only for those jurisdictions that accepted grants. They need to have a housing element that was certified by HCD. And they also need to either have a complete streets resolution, and we provided a boilerplate for them, or meet the California Complete Streets Act of 2008, which is in reflected in the general plan circulation. These are the eligible projects. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to go into them. But most of them were carried over from the prior cycle, but now they just have the flexibility to fund few of them or all of them up to whatever fund degrees they want. On the last slide, we did definitely have something to consider. We have STP and CMAQ funding rule eligibility constraints. So based on those, obviously CMAs need to be aware when they fund those programs. If for the rehab programs, they only have a limited amount of STP. So that also comes into when you design programs that needs to be considered. In terms of the outcomes of the program, we found that we increased the funding from $26.8 million to $320 million for the county program. More projects received grants. We went from 133 from the previous cycle to 195. But even though there were more projects, the average grant size did increase from 1 to 1.6 million, and the overall project size increased as well. This led in many cases to much more projects with larger impact and much more complexity that go across different transportation types of improvements. And also, in terms of the breakdown of the different kinds of projects that were funded, roughly roughly 60% of the funds involve active transportation. So that concludes my presentation, and I look forward to
talking about this. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Marco?
So, Melissa came up to me right before and said, I looked at your presentation, you have a lot of slides. I said, okay, I talked really fast. So I am going to skip through some of these very quickly, but I wanted to give you a lot of background, especially at the end. There are some examples of the types of planning projects that, need to provide a grant for, but that's after the, last title card. So that's, some examples taken from our website. But what I wanted to concentrate on today was really the substance and the outcome of our planning grant program. And to set a little bit of background, unlike MCC and SANDAG, SCAG is the largest MPO in the country, but we are strictly a planning agency. We devolve all of the infrastructure planning and implementation to our county transportation commissions. So we compile the RTP SES, but really as far as the goals and policies, a lot of it is done in discussion and in negotiation with the counties. And so when it came to combining transportation and land use, this was a very touchy subject. We also have 18 smaller COGs within our region that address more of local issues, and they range from just kind of a, group of cities that have banded together to discuss items to some that are full-fledged public agencies who, administer their tax programs and things like that. So I'll give you a little bit of background on the history, give you some of the context in the 2012 RTP SES, and then get into the program evaluation that we conducted. So this is just to kind of point out that this is a long, process since 2000 of growth visioning in the SCAG region. And so we developed something called the Compass Blueprint Growth Vision, which the process concluded in 2004. This was simply an advisory document, but this really, when you look at the growth vision, it really maps almost directly when it comes to the geography onto our recent SES. So it really did lay the groundwork for this idea that growth should be concentrated near transportation infrastructure, transit, and our roadway system. And in 2008, we did develop a comprehensive growth plan, but it was not adopted. Instead, it was adopted as an advisory plan. And one of the benefits we had, even though it made it very difficult for us in developing our SES, was that the SB 375 target setting process took place right in the middle of our four-year development cycle. So one of the things we got out of that, like I said, it made it very difficult, but it did provide us with an entire mini outreach program that we were able to continually go back to cities, to our counties, and to the public. And so they were well, it was almost like double the outreach through that process. So we adopted our RTP SES in 2012. Our Compass, our Call for Projects program has really developed organically. And that's a polite way of saying we've never planned it. It just happened on a one-off basis. And in 2010 was the first major call for projects where we started to formalize it. We conducted another call in 2013, and people always ask me, when's the next call? And I have to tell them, I don't know. It seems to average every 3 years. So I've been told it will be, it's potentially going to be sometime in 2015, because we found it a very effective way of implementing the, regional council policies. This is just some background on the growth visioning process that occurred and the Compass Blueprint. I'm going to skip that. So when we first did our first evaluation was an internal evaluation in 2012. At the end of, these are the numbers that were quoted in the SES. So by the end of fiscal year 12-13, we completed 103 projects with a contribution of $14 million. Now, because of our structure, when we're at presentations in our region and people from NTC or Portland say, yes, you know, MPOs have access to this CMAC money and this federal money, I say, shh, don't tell our cities that. Because we don't have access to that money. We pass that money along to the counties. So we use our own planning grant money from our own internal planning grant money and a pot of money that comes to us from our constituent counties. And so, again, that limits us to only planning grants. But, you know, it also allows us to do a huge diverse range of, grants. And so we're always being told, well, what's the transportation nexus? I said, well, we're in the transportation and land use integration business. And so everything has a transportation nexus. And so now we fund everything from specific plans to bike planning to neighborhood electric vehicle planning to vision studies, things that cities would probably not be funding on their own. We fund
funded studies of freeway caps. So now we're working with four different freeway cap coalitions. The idea being to cover areas where the freeway was constructed below grade, cover that freeway, and now create park space and create developable land. So again, the context here, and this map is really stunning. In 1990, I believe Amtrak was down to something like one or two trains that passed the region, but we had no regional serving rail, nothing that operated on any kind of commuter timetable. The Blue Line was constructed in 1991. Metrolink was, I believe they started operating in 92, 93. By 2010, this is now our existing regional rail system. Los Angeles County has subway light rail lines and has a fully grade separated bus rapid transit. And Metrolink is now operating in all in five of our six counties. And the 2035 plan looks to be quite extensive. And so Metro has a very aggressive, LA County Metro has a very aggressive build out of their commuter rail, and Metrolink has plans for expansion. And so we have a large area where there will be sort of the potential for great TOD, transit-oriented development, and accessible transportation. So our SES looks like this, and I said, how's the SES looking? And they say, well, green. And so what you see, when you have 38,000 square miles, a lot of it is not urban dense areas. And so our SES is really predicated on the fact that we have some very progressive, very aggressively urbanizing areas within our region. And we also have a huge part of the region that is suburban and will continue to be so, that is rural, that is agricultural based, that is protected land. And so we wanted to make sure that our SES protected all of these different values. And so going back to the conversation earlier about values with our grant program, we make it flexible so that the grants really respect the individual communities. And so that's a location of the first 133 projects. And so as you can see, we've awarded them all kinds of different contexts. So getting to the evaluation grant, by the end of 2015, we will have completed 203 projects to the tune of $24 million. The Compass Blueprint moniker has been rebranded to the Sustainability Planning Grant Program, and this is to reflect the fact that it's really targeted at implementation of the SES. And we created sort of three buckets. Now, the buckets are all funded from the same pots of money. We receive one big call for applications. We ask the applicants to sort of self-describe. We have integrated land use planning, which is what used to be Compass Blueprint. We have active transportation planning, which overlaps a little bit with what the active transportation guys are doing, but focuses more on bike planning and visioning. And then we have green regions, which is all about GHG reduction, energy conservation, resource conservation. So these all go back to the first 133 projects. And so what we did was we wanted to know where the current, where the state of the current projects that had been completed to date were. And one of the things I'm most pleased about is that we have 8% failure rate. Because I'm a true believer in innovation, and if you're not doing something wrong, you're probably not doing something really right either. So I was happy to see that some of the cities were able to do a project and say, you know what, that is not what we want to do, and that is not something that's going to move forward. In some cases, there was a lack of, I'll get to the cases of why they're inactive, but we have 34% of our projects are active and they're proceeding as was described. A lot of these are the ones that were vision plans that are now going into specific plans. But we also have research projects that the whole point was to provide information to the city for other planning efforts. And so the cause of limited progress, as you can imagine, our program really grew from 2005 to 2010, something very striking that we're all aware of happened in 2008. So the Great Recession really impacted a lot of the land use plans. And so a lot of these plans were created as plans to attract development, to enable higher density development. Well, that's the kind that evaporated for 3 years. So a lot of them, though, are being pulled off the shelf. I was reading the Orange County Register the other day, and I was pleased to see that they're referring to this 2010 plan that laid the groundwork for a intersection revitalization. Well, that was our study. So the implementation status of the active projects, again, these are the ones that are all moving forward. Many of them were formal documents that we were happy to see have been adopted or approved by a local board. Being planning only, one of the two things we can't touch is we don't do preliminary engineering. And the other thing that we've stepped away from is we don't do EIRs at all. And so what we do is we kind of fudge it a little bit. We provide a lot of the analysis that will go into an EIR, but we don't allow our money to be used for the preparation of the actual document. So cities that come to us to prepare a specific plan are going to have to fund the EIR on their own. But most of them have plans to do so, and so we get to see a lot of this stuff adopted and implemented. And so we asked a question about kind of what have you done with the final deliverables, whether they were presented for action, and so you can see about 20%, and these don't add up to 100 because people were able to select multiple. But again, a large number of them presented to a body, a planning commission or some sort of agency. A lot of the vision plans were really presented to the public. So some of our deliverables are posters, are PowerPoints, and these are things that contain a lot of information but convey something that the planning department is working on to their local communities. And that can be a challenge. That's exactly the kind of thing that a local planning department usually can't do on their own. And so a lot of times what we wanted to see was what was the intended purpose, and you can see, again, not surprisingly, a lot of land use planning, but a lot of vision planning. And again, vision planning in two categories, what we call within 2 years, where it's really part of that kind of collaborative approach to multiple engagement with the community to kind of talk about how a specific plan is going to turn out. And then vision planning that are kind of 2+ years. And so this is really what is the community going to look like in 5, 10, 15 years? But we also promote multi-jurisdictional efforts, so we have a number of projects that 5 or 6 different cities are combined to work on, some corridor planning in that area that's very challenging for cities to get together and do. And we would like to get this number up, and only 30% of the plans or projects have been used to go out and get additional funding. And so we would like to see this used more extensively, but when I was reading the comments on this question, I was very pleased to see that of those 30% have realized a lot of projects. So they would go off and get a Caltrans grant, or they would get an Urban Green grant. This project was the brochure. This was the project that gave them the data to go out for that. And we think a lot of this has to do with, of the 191 cities, some of them are very small. And so they may have only one planner on full-time, or not even that. They may have only contract staff. So one of the things that we did from the very beginning, I'll just split through those really. So as you can see, obvious geographic distribution. This is the growth in the number of projects per year. And as you can see, it's kind of been organic, 10, 11 with a catch-up year from the 10 call, and 13, 14 is going to be the same way. The total value of the projects that we've been increasing every year, and I think this year we're probably going to be doing about $6 million worth in 14, 15. And the average project, it goes up to about 200,000. So again, this is strictly planning work. And here you have kind of the main buckets of services that we provide, land use planning, vision planning, transportation, economic development, outreach, and sustainability. Now, one of the things is in the initial design, when we were doing the growth vision, one of the things that we heard back from cities was that they would get, when they got Caltrans grants or they got federal grants, one of the challenges for them was that these take sometimes 6 months to 2 years. So if you get a Caltrans community planning grant, you can easily wait for about 16 months between your award and when you get to start working. We wanted to provide flexible funding, and so one of the hallmarks of our program is that we take care of all of the procurement. So we award, and then we work closely with project managers from the cities, and we make it very clear that they're going to be the day-to-day project manager, but we receive all the invoices, we take care of all the contracting. We really wanted to create a program in which we're providing services directly to city planning staff so that they can focus on the content. And so we've been very pleased to see that many of our smaller cities have been able to do pretty ambitious things, complete a general plan or complete a major initiative that for, you know, a large city may be $2 million. For them, it could be as little as $80,000. But that's $80,000 they don't have in their general plan, in their general fund. So that's kind of how we've designed the program. And then lastly, you can see, obviously, planning department, community development. These are some of the metrics, but this is really sort of cheating. You know, we're saying this is the total study area of the projects, and we're saying, you know, this is the combined commercial square feet that's been planned for. But these are all kind of, in a planning document, you say, oh, yeah, we've created 41 million square feet of commercial space. I mean, that's all sort of wishful thinking, plan by plan. But again, going back to how the program grew organically over the years, it's really been a way to be responsive to the different characteristics of our 191 cities, the different capabilities of those cities. And so when we receive our applications, we have a four-page, we used to have a four-page maximum on your application. But we didn't want people wasting 20, 30 pages trying to tell us what they thought we wanted to hear. We wanted to know what they were going to do. And so we get great fully formatted scopes of work that are okay, they're pretty good. But then we get, you know, a two-page outline of a study that we know that a small community could really benefit from, and we'll rank that one higher. And so that's basically the structure of how we've structured this this pot of money. And again, it's our money that we see great value in funneling directly to our local communities. So that's it for our program.
Thank you very much, Marco. Okay. I don't think this is the right PowerPoint.
No. It has a red band on top, but I'll go ahead and start because I know we want to hear the next speaker. So it's a pleasure to be here today. I think these peer exchanges are just terrific. In fact, Sandbag has utilized a lot of peer exchanges similar to this to help us shape some of the grant programs that I'm going to talk about. You've seen the maps from SCAG that show the SCAG region. This is the San Diego region. We're one county, one region. Not too much smaller than the Fresno area. We're about 4,500 square miles. I think, aren't you 6,000 square miles? I have that correct. Also, somewhat similar in size in terms of local jurisdictions. We have 18 cities and one county, so I think you're 15. So it does make regional planning a little bit easier when everybody can get around one table and they know each other. And as the mayor said, you all like each other. So
help me on that.
I think that's the way we see it. We at least know each other. You have to be respectful of one another. So
that
does make some of the kind of context for all of you, I think, somewhat similar. We also have a half-cent sales tax for transportation, like your Measure C, or it's called Transnet, and that actually is what we utilize for three of the grant programs that I'm going to share with you. Like you, we have an adopted sustainable community strategy. There were targets that were set by CARB for our region for 2020 and 2035, and our plan met both of those. The plan was adopted in October of 2011, and so it was much relief, as you all may feel right now, being done. You have to do another one in 4 years. So our next plan is due roughly a year from now, we expect to be before our board of directors. So we're constantly, all of us in this phase, of preparing the next plan while you're implementing the current plan. And the good news about that is you always get a chance to make your next plan better. Similar to what you heard Craig talk about in the Bay Area, we have what's called the Smart Growth Concept Map. This was actually developed before our Sustainable Community Strategy to really help set the stage for our Sustainable Community Strategy. It's really focused on the western third of our region, and there are all these little circles which identify smart growth place types similar to what MPC did. This was done through a ground-up approach with all of our local jurisdictions. There's different place types based on the density, mix of uses, and the type of transit that will be provided. And this map has really been critical for regional planning and also setting the stage for the grant programs that we utilize. We have 230 smart growth areas identified. About two-thirds of them, the planning and zoning is in place to support that level of density. And a third of them, they're shown in these little hash marks here, that's where planning needs to take place in order to meet the density requirements, either in the zoning or in the general plan. And the reason that's important is with our Smart Growth Incentive Program grants, they're planning grants and capital grants. The areas that need to have planning done can only apply for the planning grants. And those that already have the planning done can still do more refined, apply for a grant for more refined planning, but they can also receive capital grant funds. The other thing that this map has really helped in the region, it's really helped our local jurisdictions update their local plans. And just in the last 13 years, since we've been doing a lot more work coordinating land use and transportation, these two maps show a change in a time period over 13 years. And so this is a map of our region. And the blue dots show where the projected housing growth was based on the region's plans in looking out. That was in, I think, the year 2000, we looked out at how the plans would be projected. And the purple shows job growth. Now, with our most recent growth forecast, a substantial number of the general plans have been updated, and now you see this growth has moved more toward the west in in the most urbanized areas of the region, allowing us to protect a lot more open space. And similar to your region, we have forest land, park land. More than half the region is actually open space, protected as open space. Similar to other parts of California, the demographics are changing as we look out. Our region is about 3 million people, so that's about a little more than three times the size of the population here in your region. We're projected to grow by about another million people as we look out. We're much more diverse, we're much older, more than half our population by the year 2050 will be over age 65. So that certainly has an impact on how we plan and thinking about that in terms of the grants. More than 80% of people in 2050 in the San Diego region will live within a quarter mile of what's considered high quality transit, and we're able to preserve more than half the region as open space. So as I mentioned, our Transnet Half-Cent sales tax is one of the major sources of grant funding. This was something that the voters approved in 2004. There's a $280 million set aside for these grants. Only cities in the county are eligible to apply. And in terms of putting this grant program together, it was initially conceptualized in our regional blueprint plan. And then as the tax measure was worked on, it was decided to include a set aside for these smart growth grants. And the whole idea is to reward the cities and the county in certain cases where they're doing planning that will match up with where we're making transportation investments for a more sustainable future. So we worked very closely with the planning directors and the public works directors in our region to actually put this program together. One of the strategies that we use is to put together criteria for our grant programs. We take that through a number of public workshops, through our policy committees, and have our board adopt that criteria. So then once we apply that criteria to the grants, we can't be moving around, oh, well, we really wanted this project down here to do better. Once you approve the criteria, then we sort of apply it and stand with sort of how the grants get awarded. We do a call for projects every 2 to 3 years. We've done two calls. We're getting ready to do our third call. I like the name that SCAG is now using for their grant program. So I'm thinking maybe we'll steal that this time around. We do a lot of that. So steal, take, whatever you can learn from us. I mean, MTC has phenomenal graphics. We always like their graphics. We also have a 2% set aside in our Transnet measure for active transportation. So getting to some of the things that Alan was talking about that they do in the SCAG region in terms of planning, but we also implement projects. We have a number of regional bike projects that we're tapping into this source to build the regional bike projects, and then also to give grants to the local jurisdictions to update their bike plans and to build bike and ped projects. And these really have to also be linked back to those smart growth areas, similar to the Smart Growth Incentive Program. The whole idea is making sure that people have transportation options. And then on the other side, in order to help make sure that we're maintaining our open space, our half-cent sales tax measure has $850 million set aside for our environmental mitigation program. $650 million is really just to mitigate for our transportation projects, but we have $200 million set aside, and those are grants to help maintain the open space areas, preserve various corridors throughout the region, and we do a call for projects on an annual basis through that particular program. A couple other things I wanted to call attention to. I know that you in the Fresno call have provided mini grants to community-based organizations to engage them in the planning process. We've done that as well. We were able to get some funding through the Strategic Growth Council's Sustainable Planning Program, and we're able to award 12, and now we have 14 community-based organizations, $20,000 a year to have them engage with us, not only in our sustainable, the development of our sustainable community strategy, but also to weigh in from time to time on the grant programs, give us input on how the grant programs are impacting or how we're engaging lower-income and minority communities in the planning process. And so we've had the benefit of having them established for the period of time in preparing our sustainable community strategy, but really taking advantage of them being together at the time that we're working on a number of other projects and getting their input on that. And then the last grant program I was going to mention is the Healthy Communities Campaign. And we've worked very closely with the San Diego County Department of Health and Human Services, and they were awarded a $16.1 million $3 million of that to Sandag to do a number of things, and one of them was just close to $1 million in pass-through grants that we provided then to local jurisdictions and tribal governments to do more planning for public health. And so that included everything from updating zoning to allow for community gardens, to allow for people to have goats and chickens, which maybe more used to here, but
parts.
Then also to include health elements in general plans. One of the tribal governments got a grant to do some safe routes to the school bus from the reservation. So this was a one-time funding opportunity, but one of the things that we saw happen with this particular grant program is that it really helped build awareness among our local jurisdictions. Okay, and that is the end of my presentation.
Wow.
So thank you.
Good job. Thank you so much. Thank you. So, yes, all of you. So, maybe 10 minutes for questions in this category of grant programs. What are they? How do you start them? How do you fund them? Steve.
Marco, I noticed that you mentioned that your funding can be used for economic development and market feasibility work and outreach and public relations. So how do you get around the point that it's transportation-related funding, and really how are you able to direct it to that purpose rather than direct on-the-ground transportation projects?
Well, again, we don't fund on the ground transport. So everything we do is planning.
So these are planning.
Right. So we just don't tell legal. No. What we do is the nexus that we've established is that basically the entire program has an established nexus with implementing the SES RTP, and so a lot of the economic development and feasibility studies were conducted in support of higher density in communities, and so we argue that supports the goal of increasing density around transportation infrastructure, and so therefore it fulfills the goals of our RTP SES. But with some of these, right now we're doing some habitat planning, and that's kind of tough. Contracts are looking at us kind of funny, and we say, well, if it's reducing greenhouse gas emissions or if it's improving resource efficiency, that's greenhouse gas emissions reductions that are taken off the burden of our transportation system. And so we've established that that's okay. But the overall program in general has aligns with our policy.
Thanks.
Here and then there, please.
I have a question about the One Bay Area and Sandag programs, and that is, to what extent are funds used for direct land acquisition or for conservation purposes? And if they are used that way, could you talk a little bit about how that process works? I mean, do you work with land trusts? Do you work with independent public agency?
We have, in addition to the One Bay Area grant program, it kind of falls under that cycle funding. We have a priority conservation area program, and acquisition is an eligible category in that program. We funded that program as surface transportation program funding. And when you acquire an easement for agricultural preservation where there's clearly not a transportation nexus, we have had to make a condition of those grants that applicant bring about an exchange where they could work. First of all, because they are federal funds, they need a city or a county that has a master agreement. So they usually have general funds or they have other transportation projects that they might be funding through either measure funds of the county or through gas tax funds. And they will do work with them and do an exchange. And so we give those federal funds to the transportation project in that jurisdiction, and they in turn turn the money over and they can have an agreement. Something else we did is we partnered with the State Coastal Conservancy on the program where they matched our funds at a much lower level. So that gave us flexibility. We had them select the projects, but we were on the panel along with the Association of Bay Area Governments. So this is obviously their bond funds, they definitely can do those acquisitions. We found out later in the process we wanted everything to be federally eligible so we could partner to give them both, give our money to the projects, but we found it makes a lot more sense. For some projects that are acquisition, we would use the bond funds from the State Coastal Conservancy, and then we would move our projects to those, trail projects or other things we would more heavily staff those with the federal funds.
Okay, so it can be done, but it just you have to be leveraging funds from other sources at the same time.
The Sand Egg program, we do acquire land. We've acquired 3,300 acres. The exact, structure in which those are maintained, we can follow up after, and I can talk about that a little further. But we do use those funds to acquire land.
So the key is if you have federal fund, transportation funds only, you definitely assume those are not federal transportation funds. You have to do a work.
One of the things I was going to mention is that SCAG is doing a very, very small planning study, kind of looking at factors, looking at the existing conditions for mitigation planning. But Orange County Transportation Authority has an excellent habitat program for mitigation. And so I boned up on it a little bit because I didn't know if I was going to be asked to speak about that. If you have any questions, I can put you in touch with them.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Mary.
Can you elaborate, Craig, a little bit on how you monitor expenditures to address adopted performances?
So are you talking about the projects themselves or some of the policy conditions that we had on the grants that weren't mentioned?
Well, you mentioned referring to adopting performance. Maybe that's...
We put together a performance report, and it's on the link on the end of the PowerPoint. You can go to our One Area Grant website, and you can call it the report card, where we did look at how all the cities met the requirements and what kind of projects were funded.
And that's your monitoring program?
That's our monitoring program. But in terms of the actual projects, because we're not using our funds, so just if we're using federal funds, we were able to rely on Caltrans and the Federal Highway Administration and FTA to ensure that what they said they were going to spend the money on is subject to federal audits. So that gets us out of having to ensure that those projects were actually built like they were supposed to be. So we're looking at the more program policy outcomes and conditions are what MTC looked at and did a report on.
Someone besides Jeff, please, somebody raise their hand. God, I'm kidding. I've known Jeff like 45 years, so I can make fun. Please.
All right, Craig, question for you on the Bay Area program. I thought I heard you mention certain requirements such as the city adopting, say, a complete streets policy or other items. Was that something that was easy to obtain consensus on, or were there certain member agencies who said, hey, wait a minute, I want to keep doing, say, business as usual and perhaps not utilizing the funding to implement, more pedestrian bicycle projects, for example?
I think there was some pushback. Many cities and counties view that as their planning. Those are requirements that shouldn't be regionally imposed. I think what helped us was those requirements were basically already mandated by the state, such as the Complete Street Act of 2008 and HCD certification requirements. So it wasn't that at the end of the day, we weren't really imposing new requirements, but we were expecting that they should be meeting those requirements in order for us to, implement a sustainable community strategy and provide incentives for the grant program.
Maybe if I could add something. We have something similar in our grant programs. You're not required to have a housing element to apply, but you get points if you have a housing element. And what that has shown is only the local jurisdictions that have a housing element in place have been awarded the grants. And we're talking about, that's a great idea about the complete streets. We're talking about adding that this time around. It probably would be more of a point sort of thing.
And I would have to say that for a few of the complaints, not even say complaints, but resistance that we found, ultimately everybody did it. I mean, I didn't hear many stories from any cities or counties where there was a problem. I think what we're hearing, we gave them a complete street resolution as an alternate path so they didn't have to open up their general plan. to meet the state requirements, which it's just a matter of staff taking, you know, we provided them what the 9 or 10 points are. So that really was helpful.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael?
Yes. Hi. Thank you. All three of you spoke from your respective agencies, and you used the terms land use and transportation in the same sentence, which is the way the world operates. However, in these parts, it seems like there's a reluctancy to acknowledge that. So you have transportation planners who say, no, we don't do land use, and you have, a, for example, city planners who just say, oh, no, we don't touch transportation. Can you talk about that in the context of how your organizations overcame that?
I can tell. So in the San Diego region, one of the things that SANDAG we talk about, we always say, we don't have land use authority, and we're good with that. So I think, you know, maybe the way we talk about it, in our own region is slightly different than when we're outside our region, because we respect that and we talk more about how do we collaborate, how do we work together, how do we provide incentives so that you're making land use changes that match up well with the transportation investments in the region. So I think definitely there have been growing pains, and I think there's a lot of concern with the SCS that somehow regional entities were going to have some, you know, magic wand to decide what land uses were going to be where. And we made a commitment early on with our local jurisdictions that we were going to take their general plans as they are, and that would be the land use pattern assumed for the SCS, and then we would make transportation investments based on that. And so that's where the incentives come in. That's where if you want public transit, you're going to have to be showing the higher density areas, or public transit isn't going to come to your area. So those are some of the ways that I think we dealt with that. I think it's definitely been different in the other regions. I think SCAG in particular is very different in the way you approach that.
Your question is how we overcame that, and I kind of assumed we've ever overcome that. And so we still have those conversations all the time. I mean, in our agency, we actually have a transportation planning and a land use and environmental planning department. And we do collaborate, we do work together, but there are people in the transportation department that just sometimes just say, why are we even doing an SES? And kind of got to remind them, well, we have to. the governor said so. And then the state, yeah. But I think the other thing is that in a region, if you take, for example, Orange County, which is a very suburban region, which has a very big divide between North and South Orange County, their county has consistently viewed itself as sort of not part of the greater LA region for sure, and reluctantly part of SCAG, but they see the value of their growth pattern. And I mean, one of the things we would highlight is that according to their general plans, 35% of their new development between 2012 and 2035 was going to be multifamily housing. And this is the home of the planned suburban community. And so when you turn that around and you say, when you make that a conversation about respecting local values and explaining to them that just as much as they want to preserve a certain way that they're developing, they're expecting rules to be put in place that are keeping another city from developing the way they want it to develop. And I think that's an important part of it. Riverside County, Western Riverside County is very rural in nature. And when they did their general plan update, they had to have this conversation. And they came to the conclusion that they didn't want to look like LA County. And so finally, they kind of said, well, we're going to have to preserve open space. Not everyone's going to be able to build whatever they want on their land, or you're going to be LA County. So take your pick. And so, yeah, I think that's we phrased it in a term of respecting the local values and enabling the type of land use and transportation integration that they see coming their way.
So I think we need to go on to the next and last panel. So if you can hold your question, if we get to the breakout sessions, we're kind of like way over the time thing. Whatever. It's awesome. I do think it's interesting, and from this discussion in your small group, the Valley has unique areas of incredible poverty. So I think I'd be interested to know, from your perspective, from the grant planning, how do you accommodate or adjust or respond to communities where half the folks don't work, people don't have water to drink? How does that play into it? Because it's not all having mass transit in some of our communities is like, okay, but they don't have water and nobody has a job. So if you could just speak to those kind of inequities in the breakout, I think it would be helpful. I bet that's what you're going to ask.
Yeah.